This is Damien O'Doherty on Center Maryland's The Conference Call. We are here with a very special guest today. It's my partner from KO Public Affairs, Beth Levine. Beth, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Beth has a pretty extraordinary story to tell about her career in the Senate. Her activity and her leadership on the communication side with the Judge Merrick Garland into a presidential race in a battleground Iowa, and having your own Senate race as the top communications person for Senator Grassley, and then going in and taking the Gorsuch confirmation by the reins from a communication standpoint and leading that effort. It's pretty much a trifecta, or it's just a very rare combination of experiences to have in public affairs. And as gruesome as it was for my side, I gotta congratulate you as a professional. Pretty incredible experience to be a part of.
It really was. It was surprising, to say the least. I can remember the day that Justice Scalia died, and it was a Saturday, and I was home. I was actually just sitting down to do some work, and I have at the time, I think I had a one-year-old and a four-year-old, and so I think they were napping. So it was probably like a mid-afternoon-ish, and I got a call from a reporter. It was Evan Perez from the Wall Street Journal, he's now at CNN. And he's like, hey, Scalia died. And I might have said a few choice words. He said, do you guys have a comment? And I said, no. Give me a few minutes. And then I recall the rest of the day was on the phone with, you know, our staff, Leader McConnell's staff. We had Judiciary Committee staff at the time, because Senator Grassley was chair of the committee, obviously. So we had on a committee like that, you have committee staff that works on, especially on judiciary in particular, is a little bit different. You have staff that works on policy issues, on various policy issues. And then you have a full set of staff that was, you know, I think five or six people that solely worked on nominations on the Judiciary Committee. And so, you know, we were on the phone with them till late in the night, I recall, you know, putting out statements, just like trying to get our stuff together and figure out what in the world we were going to do, because it was so unexpected. And, you know, it was a little bit scary. Grassley was in the middle of a campaign up for re-election against a very formidable opponent. And, you know, it was like, oh, what are we going to do? So.
Dial us back even before that, the Merrick Garland situation. How does that, from a leading staff point, the President of the United States comes out and says, announces his nomination, just as we saw Judge Amy Coney Barrett go through this weekend. We saw with Merrick Garland, and then the majority leader stood up and put his hand up and said, "We're not having any of it." And so, at what point, as a staff person in the Capitol working for the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, do you say, my goodness, this is the beginning of a holy war? Or maybe it wasn't the beginning, maybe it was the middle of a holy war, but it was certainly a major moment in jurisprudential history. And I'd love to hear what it's like to be a staff person when things are becoming that consequential.
You know, one of the decisions that was made early on before the president even nominated Garland, which was, I think, middle of March, was that the Senate would not consider, didn't matter who the nominee was, that the Senate would not consider the president's nominee. So that was laid out even before Merrick Garland was nominated. And, you know, it served as a benefit in one way, the fact that personalities didn't matter. Merrick Garland is one of the nicest people. I think everybody will tell you that, that you will meet. And so it just really took personalities out of the equation. And it really helped at least our side focus on the very specific facts about why we were doing this. And, you know, you talk about a holy war. I mean, our side would argue that this started long before many eons ago, but it was, you know, there's still a lot
with
of
some
feelings.
Of the same cast of characters. Yes. Some of the same cast of characters, no doubt, right?
Sadly, it started long ago with when Judge Bork was nominated. So back in the late 80s, mid to late 80s. Yeah. And our side will tell you that's when
people
it
started. People always want to forget that footnote. Like, he did have some writings that suggested that Brown versus Board of Education shouldn't be law. I'll put a little asterisk that maybe she should get him a hard time.
But anyway, even though that happened,
it's our a process, side will say, right?
It's a process. And, you know, our side, Justice Ginsburg, nominated, confirmed, I think almost, if it wasn't unanimously, it was almost unanimously. I mean, there are numerous justices or judges at the time that Clinton nominated, and Senator Hatch was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee at the time. And he's like, we're starting over, you know, no hard feelings. These people are qualified. We're done. And then you had some circuit court nominees come when President Bush, after President Bush was inaugurated. And I can recall a very qualified Hispanic nominee who the Democrats did not want us to confirm. And he sat, I think, for maybe 3 years waiting to be confirmed and finally withdrew. So, you know, there's a long, long history of this. Whether you're for or against, whether you love McConnell or you don't like him at all, I mean, there's obviously people who hate him and there are people who love him, but he is a master of the Senate rules. And I don't think anybody will argue with that.
Yes, he is. He's a very formidable opponent to not just a progressive cause, but, you know, in many cases, in my view, functional government. And he's willing to put his party's priorities well ahead of the country's. I think that's what we're seeing here. And you know, I can't say it wouldn't be done if it was on the other. You know, if the Democrats had control of the Senate and had the presidency at this time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just it, Damian, is that it's gone on for so long that no matter who was in this position, I think the other side would argue, say, they would be doing the same thing. So get over it and let's get through it and be done with it.
Well, with that in mind, you know, what room is there in this process for people that care about, you know, let's say the Affordable Care Act? There's, you know, I think like 11 minutes after the Senate confirms her, presumably, I bet the justice won't even have time for her investiture before she hears the Affordable Care Act case. And, you know, we could have a nuanced legal argument about the many different ways that that could come out, you know, sort of redirecting things back to the legislature or canceling the law altogether or canceling parts of the law or upholding the whole thing. We just don't know what's going to happen, but we know, right, you know, December 10th or something like that, the ACA case is going to be heard. What room is there for regular Americans that have just gone through this coronavirus experience that, you know, and others that are becoming acutely aware of what the words pre-existing condition mean? You know, it's like, what opportunity do they have to sort of lay the marker down here in this process to remind people that, you know, instability in that conversation is can't help this country advance? I mean, I'm sure you have a different view of the law, but is there room to have a, sort of a policy conversation about this and try to pin the Supreme Court justice down or is nominee down, or is that just sort of an impossible task.
Well, I mean, to be honest, she shouldn't be. I mean, she shouldn't be giving her opinions on any of these things that could become, that could come before the court. So, I mean, she shouldn't be swayed by public opinion. Her job is to decide the case on the facts and the merits and the law and the Constitution. So while you can, I think the grassroots has a very big role in reaching out and trying to sway their elected officials, it's not her job to listen to public opinion until it comes before the court as a matter of a case.
So as a leading staff member, you are 2 days out from the Supreme Court nomination from the president. He announces on Saturday. Today, by our count, is Monday as we're recording this. What's going through your mind? What are you being faced with? Where are you trying to drive the conversation?
You know, before somebody is actually nominated, we have a general idea of probably the two or three who it'll be, just like everybody else. But, you know, that staff, who the five or six staff, and then the Senate generally appropriates additional monies for the two committees, the Judiciary Committee, both Republicans and Democrats, an equal amount of money to hire more staff. And what amazed me during this whole process was the amount of material that was coming into the office. I mean, it was boxes and boxes of stuff. And I mean, this was, you know,
when you say more staff, are these young people that are just coming out of law school? Are they prominent practicing attorneys that you get to sort of attract into the battle for a couple months? How does that, what kind of professionals are those?
Both, to be honest. Generally, they're younger, you know, they're associates at law firms downtown who are interested in this process and being a part of it. And then there's always, you know, one or two, you know, more experienced folks thrown in there who may not have as much time to spend in the conversation, but, you know, will come help out as they can and see fit. You know, they might be a friend of somebody. One person we had help was in the case that I had with Justice Gorsuch was, you know, somebody who had clerked for him years before prior and actually was an Iowan. And he came to help out, but he was, you know, quite a bit older and more experienced. So you have a mixture of both, but generally I would say it's younger people who lawyers who are working downtown.
And then there, you said, I interrupted you as you were saying, you're in just boxes, a whole cavalry boxes coming at you. That's all sort of research that you need to absorb or distill.
Yeah, I mean, these folks go through every single piece that this person has written, whether it be in law school. I mean, we saw Kavanaugh's calendar from college, you know, as part of what they was a big part of the discussion. So they are going through every piece of paper, file, email that these folks have had, and it doesn't matter what it is. But this group of, you know, talented lawyers who have come to work on this, they're reading every single one, and I can recall them. You know, just this amount of material. And it was because part of it was because, like, my boss was giving a speech on the Senate floor almost every day during this whole process. And, you know, especially even during the time of when we are dealing with not holding hearings for Garland, for Merrick Garland, he was on the floor all the time, you know, justifying that decision and laying out the facts of why. He probably said Vice President Biden's name, you know, a million times during those 8 or 9 months. So, but laying out the case every single week. And then when Judge Gorsuch, now Justice Gorsuch, was nominated, it was every single day. And those speeches, if you go back and look at them, They are just chock full of facts and information on the rulings that this person has had, the writings that they've done. I mean, it's just a machine.
Speaking of the machine, my law professor, Charles Tiefer, was the House of Representatives Legislative Council. And he always used to say, the House runs like a machine and the Senate is the chamber of chaos. But it sounds like, you know, there's an average time of about 70 days for the confirmation process of the Supreme Court justice to get underway and get completed. We're going to be under that by a bit with this expedited experience. You know, do you see the political, I guess my question is, why are there no breaks anymore? I guess we had the filibuster, so we could say the Democrats took that away, but it doesn't seem like the chamber of chaos, and you might disagree with that point of view, it doesn't seem like there's many options to slow this thing down at all. And everybody's on the Sunday shows from the Democratic side saying, this thing's baked, I'm afraid, and we're going to have sort of the next conversation. Or alternatively, they're having a conversation that reflects off the Senate races that are going on around the country or reflects off the presidential race. But this cake is kind of cooked, isn't it?
Yeah, you can all thank Harry Reid for that. But when the filibuster on judicial nominees disappeared, it was you know, a major change in Senate rules, and you know, protected the filibuster. You know, as much as people might hate it or love it, it protects the minority. I mean, that's the purpose of it, and ensures that there is debate on an issue or a nominee, and you don't have to have that now. So, you know, it was really an important feature, and it's unfortunate that I think it went away, in my personal opinion, because I really do think it helped ensure that there was debate and people could have their voices heard. But yeah, there's some.
I don't mind some of those old vestiges going away. It gives me a little hope that something can be done with that electoral college. But speaking of all of what's going on in Washington with Supreme Court confirmation, we've got the presidential race underway. We've got these amazing Senate and House races going on all over the country. What's your take of the current state of play since the death of Justice Ginsburg versus before that news came to us all?
You know, historically, Republicans have been much more motivated in an election by the judiciary and by a judicial nominee. Now, I don't know that it's totally change, it will have changed this time. But I do think because it's Justice Ginsburg, it will motivate Democrats more than normal. But I still think having a focus on the judiciary and a Supreme Court nomination generally helps Republicans. Probably not quite as much this year as it normally does, but I still think it will. It's just something that the Republicans have focused on much more than Democrats over the years. And I don't know why that is, but I can recall going to a fundraiser with my boss, you know, gosh, probably 15 years ago. It was early on in my career with him. And we were at a fundraiser. It's just a small house party, you know, in rural Iowa. And Mrs. Grassley was there with us. And she made the comment about how important these elections were because of our judiciary. And that was the first time I'd really heard that, but it was something that, and they, you know, that really resonated with just these grassroots, you know, rural Iowa folk. And it was probably the biggest cheer of the night. And it's just something that has really hit home with Republicans much more than it has with Democrats, I think.
You know,
I think it'll be more this year, but not quite. I think it still benefits Republicans.
Yeah, I feel like once you get into the Supreme Court conversation, it gets us, even though it's hyperbolic because of the timing and all things Trump, I just feel like once you're having that conversation, it's like, oh, it's 50-50 America again. It's not like, you know, there's a lurch towards that mindset versus, you know, as a Democrat and somebody that's been frustrated with the president's performance, you know, you'd much rather have a conversation about his about his malfeasance on COVID, or, you know, why we're seeing a failure to address these criminal justice issues on a massive scale, or what have you. So, you know, and then Joe Trippi, my favorite blue crab there from Maryland, or not from Maryland, but he has a spot on the Eastern Shore. He says this is going to be 1980s, just what the Republicans did to the Democrats in the Senate. He said it's going to be 1980 the other way, that the Republicans are just going to suffer catastrophic losses in the Senate. You got a more hopeful outlook, I bet.
Not really, not right now.
fair enough.
Although I do think there's a lot of time left, and a lot's going to happen, you know, in the next 6 weeks. So I think there's a chance they can still hold it, but I'm not optimistic. I mean, I appreciate it. I want it held for my own, you know, my old boss's sake. So he can be chairman again, but, it's looking tough.
I got an extra ticket for our Nancy Pelosi event with her old high school pal, County Executive Ted Venatulis, and his bride, Lynn. So if you're looking for a little time with the speaker on Zoom, just let me know.
Okay, I will do that. I pass it along to my dear husband.
Last thing I want to ask of you, Division I basketball, you're a big star there in Iowa. What do you see of the future of women's college basketball sort of in this COVID and then post-COVID era? What's do you have any reaction to what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for them. You know, I played at Iowa State. Well, I spent a lot of time sitting beside Coach Fenley, but I was there at every game.
Sat on the bench, but then you put the justices on the bench. So
right.
You got the whole thing covered.
I mean, I think they're just waiting they're in such limbo right now that, you know, my niece plays down at George Washington, and the basketball teams are on campus. Nobody else is, but you know, they're just kind of doing their thing and waiting because schedules they just came out with something new last week, I think, the NCAA, about when you can actually start having games. And so, you know, a lot of games are having to be canceled that are in that early part of the season, and conferences still haven't made up their mind about what to do. So I just feel bad for them because they're living in a lot of limbo. I mean, like the rest of us, but I mean, these kids they play Division I college basketball. They're the toughest, smartest, most hardworking, you know, kids that in the country. So they'll get through it and they'll figure out a way to, you know, there'll be better people for it. I'm certain of it, but it sucks for them because that's what they want.
Sounds like folks on my side need to talk to Leader Schumer and get more Division I women's basketball players on our side of the fence so we can handle these things as ably as you all seem to be doing these days.
Well, I told them we had an intern once who played volleyball at, I think, a Division III college, and she was showing me her resume, and I said, why don't you have that you play volleyball? And she said, I don't know. I said, I'm going to tell you what, if I see that you're an athlete, a college athlete, because I know how hard it is, that I will always give you an interview. And she said, oh, really? You know, so
Yeah, because that's about showing up. Because you don't know the kid, you know, the C student or the A student. You don't know if they were skipping class or if they were there every day. You never know.
That's right. If you're an athlete, you're going to class. You're, you know, managing your schedule. You're dealing with a coach who may or may not like you. You know, you're dealing with a lot of things.
Iowa, you're from Iowa, where college matters. So I'm from Baltimore, where high school matters more than anything, and I just can't imagine our my alma mater, that one of the best high school basketball teams in the country at Mount St. Joe there on the west side of Baltimore. Those kids, they can't play basketball, they can't go to the mass, there's nothing that they can do. I can't imagine being a 15-year-old, 16-year-old boy and you know, nothing, no dances, nothing. So
it's, yeah, serious stuff.
All right, well, Beth, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, happy to do it. This was fun. I really enjoyed it.
You will make the change. You'll begin today.